Hello, and welcome to Studio Sessions, the big red and shiny podcast where we talk with artists about the ideas, inspiration, and processes that go into their work. I'm your host, Matt Kuhlman, and my guest this episode is Ryan Turley. Ryan earned his BFA from Parsons, the New School for Design, in 2009, and his MFA from the Pratt Institute in 2011. Much of his work uses the rainbow spectrum through various methods, and he creates pieces that raise questions not just about sexuality, but perceptions of societal labels in a larger sense as well. His work moves through many different forms, ranging from 2D paintings to sculptures to large outdoor installations. Join me as Ryan describes the different ways he's explored his ideas in his work and how they are represented in each piece. How you doing?
I'm good.
Thanks for meeting with me here today.
Thank you.
In your studio in Bushwick, in the Fireproof Studios. And so, I've looked through a lot of your work, and correct me if I'm wrong, you love rainbows and the spectrum, is that right?
A lot of my most recent work has sort of riffed off the rainbow and pride colors. I think it's most recently gone a little bit away from pride colors and more into just the idea of spectacle and the word spectacle and this sort of experience you get with light. Okay. and a little bit moving away from the socio-political things that deal with sexuality that I was sort of very interested in undergraduate studies and my thesis and also in my graduate studies, but more taking it to a less personal place and more of something that's accessible to everybody and less of just about my agenda.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it was a kind of political thought process that led you to start working with that kind of vein?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. A lot of it started with the piece called Frivolous, which was a totem, and I was working with these totems earlier in sort of my undergraduate study, and then it became this idea of pride and frivolity of pride, and this...
By totem, do you mean like a pole or...
Right, yeah, okay. almost like a phallic structure that's jutting up through space. Okay. And this piece was 1 foot by 1 foot cubes of plexi that I stuffed with 50,000 yards of hand-curled curling ribbon in the colors of the rainbow pride flag. So this idea of what is pride? What is gay pride? Is there a difference? And why is it, you know, it's sort of become this frivolous thing that Budweiser sponsors or something like that. And less about like what Stonewall was and more about like Sky Vodka, you know? So this sort of thing and not really taking a stance on it, but just putting it there. So I hope to not like shove anything down the throats of people, but more like bring it up and have a conversation about it and put it in your mind. Or you can just look at it and be like, that's a really fun, bright color.
Yeah.
You know? So it's sort of allowing people to have access to things that's comfortable and sort of luring them that way. And then if they choose to look at it further or get what I'm talking about, then that's great. That's, you know, that's icing on the cake. But it's less important for me to just hit you over the head with a verbal attack about this is my stance and this is what you should think, and I'm because I don't really care. So it's like it's not my job to try to guide you there. So it's just sort of what I need to express, and then hopefully you can take something from it.
You were kind of seeing gay pride movement kind of being co-opted at that time. What time period was this that we're kind of talking about?
I mean, for me, it's current. You know, it's what it is now.
But when you made that piece, I mean,
that was only, it was probably 4 or 5 years ago. So I think it was, I was not a young, you know, just coming out of the closet, sort of, you know, running to a parade and dancing around and having whatever. You know, it was more of, what is this? Like, what looking at is it as it was a spectacle? As well, what? Why do people go to this parade? What are we doing? Is this benefiting the community? Is it not? I don't know, you know. So it's this sort of, that's where the idea, this thing kept coming back about spectacle and about, am I part of that spectacle? Is that what I want my legacy to be as a man, as a gay man, as a, you know, so so it's that sort of those ideas that I was felt really conflicted about. And I and I started making this work, but then I felt conflicted about that work. So I was like, well, I'm just making objects about it. So I'm sort of doing the same thing and I'm selling them. So it's like, what am I doing with that? So I think currently I've sort of gone a little bit away from that and use them as purely aesthetic things that, that at base are mesmerizing, you know, and is my color palette now. So
at that time you were, just kind of making objects to try to contemplate the situation. You were trying to figure it out in a way. Still.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, okay. I think that's what you do. And especially in graduate school, I was just making everything. And then I was like, well, why am I making objects? What is...
Yeah.
What? And I just kept making these objects.
Yeah,
and I just kept making and making. And it was, I was very prolific. And, you know, professors would be like, that's great. You've got so much work. And I was like, that's not anything. That doesn't mean anything. Like, one professor would be like, oh, you know, there's your thesis show. And I was like, I have no idea what that is, you know? So what is that? How does that help me? So I think that's why I'm slowly moving into, or quickly, obviously moving into, installation works and hopefully public art. And cause I feel like that's a direction that will help me deal with it more in the public realm. I'm talking about all these social issues, but I work in a studio. I have a private studio. I've always had a private studio. I work alone.
Yeah.
How am I getting my information? Where is my inspiration? So that's the difficult part that I'm trying to work through. And I feel like doing public art and having done this piece up in Minnesota and then this recent piece working with very closely with, the director at, the gallery I was working with was very helpful because I had to lose control a little bit. Like, give over to other people's rules and other people's stipulations and what they thought instead of just making this object. Somebody liked it. They didn't know that much about it. Then a show happens. Then the piece goes. Like, so it was this more of a community-based project. And I think that makes me feel more relevant and just in what I'm doing for myself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
you mentioned the piece up in Minnesota, and that was much more out in the open, obviously.
Yeah,
it's a big piece. Can you explain, like, how that came about?
Well, I think it's really interesting because my work that I applied to that piece, it was a Jerome Fellowship Foundation grant, which is a great group that provides a lot of money for New York-based artists and Minnesota artists. And this was a place called Franconia Sculpture Park, and they offer different fellowships through the Jerome Foundation, and also they have interns and all these other programs, and they support a lot of young artists and emerging artists. And I had applied with an idea of sort of coming off these. I was making these objects with rainbow colors and all these sort of, you know, these themes. And then I was like, well, why don't I actually try to make a rainbow? What is a rainbow? What is the spectacle? What is the spectrum?
Mm-hmm.
And so I started experimenting with this diffraction film, which actually just splits white light.
Okay.
I didn't really know exactly what this piece was going to be. I submitted a very simple sketch, basically, that was a sort of collage sketch, which is how I sketch most things out. I don't do a lot of drawing. And it was a bunch of prisms on a grass field and, you know, wishful thinking that rainbows would shoot through these things and they'd be, you know, light up the hill with these prisms.
Mm.
And... but I applied with a lot of other work that was from, you know, my thesis show, which was about sexuality and youth and sexuality. I was very shocked that a public place even would look at my past work and be like, oh, he's perfect for this family park, you know? That's what I also was afraid of. I was like, well, how do you push the boundaries but still, you know, survive and make art in the public realm and it be successful and possibly purchased it? Not that that's happened, but you know, but how do you approach that? And so... they took a chance, which was great, and so I made this piece, and it ended up being really successful. It was the hardest thing I've ever worked on. It was massive. It's almost 2,000 square feet.
Really?
I'd never worked outdoors. I've never dug a hole. You know, I'm a city kid. I don't, you know, this was a farm. I think it's a couple acres.
Yeah, where exactly is it in Minnesota?
It's about an hour north of the Twin Cities.
Okay.
In a little
town.
Really
is out there.
It's really out there. I think they call it the Lakes District or something like that. I mean, I think there's some vacation homes out there, but otherwise it's farms.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the director there had originally, years and years ago, started with Socrates, and then he decided with a bunch of buddies that he was going to go up to Minnesota, buy this farm and do the same thing out there. So, I mean, you drive down this highway where there's nothing, and then all of a sudden there's just crazy sculpture everywhere. So it's a place where you can work really large. They take a lot of chances on people, and it's really exciting and super beneficial to me to be able to work out there, because you're working with a lot of people from all over the world. The public is there the entire time. So people are coming up to you and they're saying, what is this? What are you doing? And so for me, it was really good because I came from, you know, academia, where we sit in a room with other artists and we talk about art to people that know about art, and that's all they want to talk about. So these people, you know, a lot of them were truckers, and they were like, and I'm out there.
What you doing out there?
Yeah, and I'm making a bunch of rainbows in the field, and they're like, you know, and they were cool. They were like, this is great. This is, or they were like, I don't, whatever. And, you know, but for me, that was really good. And I feel like I grew a lot there because I had to be honest. I was there for 2 months. So every day dealing and speaking to people that I would not necessarily ever run into ever, and not in a gallery. So,
yeah.
So I think that was the most beneficial part for me, working there. And then the piece, it was great because it actually worked, which was a scary part for
it
me. So
lit up the whole,
it lit up, it worked. And I mean, just having something outdoors is really something I've never thought about. Mm-hmm. And I mean, a lot of my stuff is finicky and tight, you know, it's a lot of little pieces and it's a lot of handwork. And out there it was, how is this not going to break? How are kids going to be able to maneuver through this and not get impaled on it? How are they not going to break it? You know, so building the structures, and thank God there were so many really great assistants out there for me, like carpenter people and people that could actually help me build it, because I've never built anything like that. So it was great all around. So, you know, as far as meeting new artists that have a different skill set than myself, to people that have a totally different mindset to what I have. I mean, it's Minnesota too, so it's different than the city, so you know, and the gallery world. So,
how exactly does that piece function? Like at noon, when the sun's the highest, does it like really like shine? And like,
so
the rainbow's kind of
it's
like
actually it's interesting. Yeah, it's actually sunrise and sunset when because it's so flat, which is actually really great and actually really behooved the situation, because there's nothing in its way. So, I mean, it's very low to the ground. These sort of triangular prisms sit up about maybe a foot and a half out of the ground on a slight platform.
And they're on like a triangular platform.
They're on a bed, yeah. They're on a sort of raised bed, like almost a garden bed, a triangular garden bed that's filled with jet black mulch. And then, I mean, there's a whole system underneath that is holding, like, two by sixes that are holding all the pieces in this grid system. And so as the sun rises, it hits it hard, and so you get this shimmering effect. And then as the sun goes up to the top, it almost disappears. The plexi panels almost completely disappear, and it doesn't, you know, there's no scar on the landscape, really. So it's just a slight hue, and then as it comes down to sunset, it explodes again. And I mean, it was great. And the fun thing that actually happened was, as you walk around it, it actually chases. So the whole thing moves, and so it's not anything you can really grasp, which is exciting. It's just constantly changing as a rainbow. You can't catch it.
It's like a natural light show.
Absolutely. So it was great. I didn't want to do anything synthetic. I wanted to keep it natural. I didn't want to, like, you know, blast the environment there, because there's a lot of competition in that field. And I just wanted it to be a quiet piece, but at the same time have its moments. So it was a happy accident that it actually started moving and things like that. And what was also interesting is that I was thinking a lot about these sort of dualities and these sort of happy, sad, these moments, and looking at something that looks, I mean, it looks like you're coming to a sort of a monument, like
really
a tribute
does.
Or
like
something.
Stonehenge kind of.
Right. So it almost looks like people won't step into it, which I totally didn't account for. I thought they'd be all over it, but people are really respectful of it and walk around it. I don't know if it's a triangular thing or it's just... It looks like
something you're not supposed to.
You're not supposed to, which is really interesting, because then it's so playful. Because it's also very playful, but it's also serious. And so that sort of playing with those dualities is really interesting to me, and that's sort of where I think my work is moving. And where do we lie with these sort of... Is it a happy thing? Is it a sad thing? It's like, you know, if it's a monument, is it death? Are we celebrating this? Or are we in the gray area, which I think we all are? It's like, it's not one or the other. It's probably somewhere in the middle for you. And then you're able to move around this thing and experience that sort of conflict, you know, that I kind of want to, this is a fun thing, but it's also, I feel reverent, you know, it's, mm-hmm. So that's a sort of, direction I think a lot of my stuff is going in now because of those experiences I had there with this piece.
It could also be a Pink Floyd monument too.
Absolutely, yeah. That I just didn't even think about until you know, it got out there, and everybody was like, "That's what that is," and I was like, "Okay, yeah, yeah, absolutely, absolutely."
So getting to the dualities that you're talking about, there's some obvious pieces where you start exploring that. Yeah. You want to talk about where those are heading?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, the one that we're here with right now, this the Jolly Roger, is a definite, like, hits you over the head a little bit more with it. It's, mm-hmm. you know, thousands and thousands of happy face stickers making the skull and crossbones, and the skull and crossbones stickers making the happy face. And
on the same panel.
Right there, yeah. So that was before Franconia and before I did the spectacle piece. And so that sort of started that whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was a successful piece. I just think it was a little bit more on the nose. And something I'm probably trying to get away from doing. And I mean, I guess I could think about it as a sketch for these larger pieces, because I don't make little sketches. So it's, I make pieces, and then hopefully they turn into a sketch.
You just work big. And
yeah. So I mean, that's sort of where that came from. And then most recently is the High-Low installation that I did for ArtBridge, which is a direct riff from Spectacle.
Yeah, I saw the similarities where you're using that same refractive material. Can you explain exactly what the setting was? It looked like a room with, like, kind of all these materials installed in there.
It came out of, I met with the director there, his name's Jordana Zeldin, and we had spoken before I left for Minnesota, and she had seen the sketch for this, and she was interested, and she said, "Oh, keep me in contact," and she runs the space over there at ArtBridge in Chelsea, and I said, "Yeah, of course," and so then she had seen it, and I had been invited to do a group show possibly there. It's a very small space. It's a project room. It's maybe, I want to say, like 100 square feet at best. Mm-hmm. It's a very high room, but it's a very small room as a footprint. It was a broom closet that they that they made into a gallery. What they do, what they're mostly known for, is if you go by a construction site, or you see, well, now at the Barclay Center they have it, is they do these large-scale prints of artists' work.
Okay.
And they print them enormously huge, and then they cover the scaffolding, so beautifying the neighborhood, getting emerging art out there, and it's an amazing program. So we had talked about doing something like that, and then we did a studio visit, and she came and she had seen what's kind of fallen down in my studio and not really up anymore is this sort of I experimented with doing it indoors and what I could do with this diffraction film with synthetic lighting.
Mm-hmm.
So pushing it further, possibly, you know, still playing with different dualities, sort of, you know, still natural and synthetic, but now it's synthetic lighting, but still using natural earth. And these are the things I want to do in an indoor environment where I could control everything.
Mm-hmm.
Because outdoors I was not able to control everything.
Yeah.
So it's still standing, so hopefully some things are controlled over there. But so she ended up deciding to allow me to take over the space and build out whatever I wanted, basically. So after a lot of studio visits, a lot of discussion, and this is where I'm saying, like, I kind of handed over part of the decision making to her, and it was more like a discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And we were able to hash this out and create something totally different that did riff on what I wanted to do, but I was able to create something that's very different, that is more of an overall experience where you're sort of climbing into the space. You open the sort of black curtain and you come into this space, and you're hit with one, the scent. So it's a very rich earth smell. I mean, it's full of mulch.
Yeah.
which is very earthy. And at the beginning, it was way too earthy, and we were very nervous that this wasn't going to go away. But it became more like soil, and it was a good thing. But you're actually, you walk, I couldn't go really into the space. I had to go up into the space. So you hit a platform immediately, and you're going 5.5 feet straight up into the space. So you're climbing from the second you walk in. So it's disorienting, you know, which is part of it. So
I can kind of see that slant in the photo.
Yeah, I mean, when we first built it out, it was insanely steep without any dirt, and it was just a platform, and I was like, oh my god, no one's going to be able to walk into this thing, and they're going to fall down. But then those things were considered, there were bars put in. I didn't want to hide anything in this. I'm not into like that piece of Franconia doesn't hide anything. It is what it is. Those pieces act that way. People might think there's something happening with lights underneath or something, but it's not. It's sun, it's film, it's dirt.
Mm-hmm.
So this was, I didn't want to change anything except for the light source, which was LED lights, the film, and dirt, and wood.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's the same elements, but now I'm just using a different light source. But it's a completely different feeling. Everything's exposed. All the cords are exposed. I'm not hiding anything. So that was important to me. Because it's not an illusion to you unless you let it. And if you're comfortable with the space, if you see, okay, I have a bar to reach onto, I can sit here, I see what's happening here, you stop trying to figure it out, and maybe you just think about something.
Yeah, just
you
take it in for what it is.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, how is he lighting that?
Right.
Like, oh, I can see the cord that goes to that light, and that's what's happening. So.
Absolutely, because Giordano and I talked a lot about sort of the light and space movement, and you know, this sort of these artists that were doing amazing things, but they were illusions. You know, they were like,
what exactly? Can you tell me more about that? I'm not too familiar with.
So, like using light, so like Robert Irwin or something like that, using these, you know, big, huge lights and scrims to create space.
Okay.
And I think that's amazing that she had asked me. She's like, well, what are you doing different? Or what are we going to do that's different here? And I said, well, it's completely different. Because I'm not creating an illusion. I'm creating an environment where illusionistic things are happening, but you're allowed to see how they happen. So you don't sit there, like, I find when I look at sort of those types of lighting experiments or these installations, I'm like, how did they do it? And so I get fixated on that, and I don't walk away with anything else.
Yeah.
I walk away with either figuring it out and getting that aha moment, or I don't remember it, you know? So... I think for me it was important to sort of, what am I going to do with this? You know, what am I going to figure out here? And that was really to allow people to figure out what I did, and for the most part, and sit in there and have this experience, because there's three different seating areas. So there's two different seating areas with three different seats.
Okay.
So as you come in and you climb up to the top, you're looking all around you. There's stuff happening everywhere. All these sort of lights, explosions. Or moments, really, and then you get to the top, and I said there has to be somewhere to pause, so that's why the seating came in. And so there's you climb into the space, you sit, and there was no time limit, and only three people were allowed in. I mean, we had the opening from 6 to midnight. We extended it really long. We had a line of
three people,
you know, they were allowed to be in as long. And it was a really hot night, and there's air conditioning in the room, so there's also this sort of cool air blowing on you. It's a very strange experience. I don't know how else to describe it. I mean, it's a strange experience. And I think for a lot of people, they said, well, I don't know if I got it. And I said, that's perfect. Like, that's fine. Like, it wasn't one thing you were supposed to understand or take from it. It was hopefully that you felt awkward or strange, or how come he let this stuff hanging out, or how come he didn't try to hide that from me? But that's an experience. That's something I feel that's different, and hopefully... I don't know if it's enjoyable, but definitely makes you be able to think about something else while you're in there instead of figuring it out.
Yeah, it definitely lends itself to not necessarily figuring out, because it's just a place to be. It's like if you go to a park, you're not supposed to figure out the park.
Yeah, exactly. I love that. Yeah, exactly. It's exactly that. That's fantastic. I think I was talking with Giordano today. We were doing a little writing about it, and she was mentioned one person that went in to this space and said, came back out and said, well, I think you need to turn it on. It was a friend of hers. She said, I don't know if it's it's not working. She's like, what are you talking
you
about?
You sound like that shit, man.
Yeah, yeah. So she peeked in and she was like, what are you talking about? And it's this sort of anticipation, like, well, what else is to happen? And I mean, this is not to say, like, there's crazy stuff happening in there with light and diffraction and refraction and whatever's happening with this light and all these sensory things. But then people want something to move, maybe, or something to... But nothing changes.
Yeah.
It's stagnant. Mm-hmm. So it only changes with your movement and you in the space. So therefore, every spectator or every participant changes the environment. And they're mm-hmm. in the space. And when new people come in, so they don't all leave at the same time. So we're also talking about when one person leaves, when the new person comes in, it's almost like this other hierarchical thing going on, because these people are way above you and they're like, well, I've got it. I'm here. I get it now. You know, you're just a newbie here.
Yeah.
So this was also a very interesting thing that was happening. And this also played off the high-low thing. So this sort of, you know, I've done stuff about high and low culture and hierarchical structure. And, you know, I did a bunk bed piece about, you know, it's called top, bottom, other. And that was like, that was sort of a lot of where this duality stuff came from as well, because I was interested to be like, well, how come we're so, it's so ingrained in us to want the top bunk. We want it. Want it as kids.
Oh, I
know
the top bunk.
Right. No one tells us why. We're just like, it's better. It's cooler. I'm higher. I can see more. So it's just, it's ingrained in us to want that. And I was like, that is just, it's odd. You know, I don't know why. It's more annoying to get up there. It's more annoying to fall out. So it's all this other stuff. But that's social and class structure is that way. And I think that all these pieces are starting to make more sense to me of where my mind is at, because they're all dealing with that in some way.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, talking about that bunk bed piece, so it did look visually interesting. You had a bunch of mirrors, like, mounted to it. How specifically did you approach the kind of top bunk mentality there?
That was, like, that piece for me was, at least for me, I have very few pieces that I know exactly what they're going to look like, and I've been wanting to make it for a long time, and then I made it, and it was exactly how I envisioned it. I wanted a plain bunk bed it's sort of an IKEA bunk bed that I deconstructed a bit. I took off ladders. It's just a straight up wood bunk bed.
Mm-hmm.
It's got, you know, a mattress on each one and a pillow on each one, and it's screen printed top on the sheets and bottom on part of the sheets, and those are all reversed. So the bottom's on the top, the top's on the bottom, the pillows are reversed, and then all the mirrors basically reflect backwards, so they're vanity mirrors. So this is also this top bottom thing is also it's a vanity description, especially sexually. You know, it's this sort of I'm just a top, I'm just a what is that, and and generally it's not true. So you know, it's generally a thing that is maybe it's a masculine thing or a machismo thing, especially in gay culture, to consider yourself just a top, and so it's playing with this sort of. That's a silly idea, and, you know, for me, it's a silly idea, and I think a lot of people got it, you know, and it's whether you got it because you thought you wanted the top bunk as a kid, or whether you were a gay male and you're only a top, or what, you know, any of those things are in that piece, and I think it was a simple, straight-up way to be like, hey, look at this. This is a very silly thing that we say all the time, you know, and it's like, I'm going to be on top, you know, I'm going to be
the best.
The winner, the best, and it's like, it doesn't matter, we're all sort of in the, you know, in that middle, so it's not, you know, you might be on either side of it, but you're probably not one or the other, you know, and it's, so that was an earlier piece that I did beginning of graduate school that I think now actually makes the most sense to me from the work I did. And I did it like first, which was weird, but I've come back to it. And I mean, the mirrors are, there's 69 mirrors and they're, you know, they're vanity. And so that also plays on it. And, you know, some of them magnify and some of them are just regular. So it's, they're built all around the piece. So there's no sort of which way is up. And the bed looks, if you could flip the whole bed over, it would look the same.
Yeah,
so,
pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah.
What are some other ways that your kind of duality focuses manifest in some pieces?
Well, I think for me right now, coming the show is still up and I'm still working with this high low thing. I'm actually developing a sort of piece that I can take away from it, because once this piece is down, I don't have anything left from it. I have some images, I have some reviews, I don't know if I'm ready to let it go. So I talked with the gallery, and we're working on a lamp, actually. It's basically, if you took the entire room and you shrunk it down into a plexi cube, what would this installation be? And so I'm sort of working hard on that now, and it's being fabricated right now, and I have more fabricating to do at the end of the week, and then making it, I mean, I don't want to say product, but it's something that I feel that as an artist I have to think about, and especially going into making installation work, how do I make money and how do I live and you know, pay student loans, you know, so that's what I'm working on now. So my head's sort of still in that space. I have other projects that I'm proposing right now that for different sort of public art projects that are in parks, and working with this idea of what, and the, like one of them's in Staten Island, and I went to visit the site, and it was just a very depressed looking park. There really wasn't anything in there, and I mean, it was like, you know, an old fountain that had no water in it, and you know, trees that didn't look good, and you know, they just looked sad, and I said, well, you know, what could I do here to make it, you know, to address the situation without being like, oh, you have a really shitty park or something, you know, and so I'm proposing these sort of large banner pieces that, like, one, you know, they'd be sort of larger than life size, probably, you know, 20 feet by 20 foot size scrims that I, you know, screen print on, a red tricycle, a big ice cream cone, you know, these sorts of, like, a picnic blanket with a picnic basket on it. Are these things happening in this park? I didn't see them happening in the park. Why don't they happen in this park? Yeah. Sort of taking you, giving you sort of visual clues to what could be here. Why aren't these things here? How does that make you feel? Am I thumbing my nose at this park by putting these up there? Probably a little bit. So that's sort of the way I'm going in now. I don't think I've totally hashed that idea out, but I can, you know, visualize how it would be a striking thing and something I would want to see in a park, because there'd be billboard size, and it's sort of like advertising. It's advertising ideas. I'm not selling you any of these things. Mm-hmm. It's just ideas. So I'm sort of interested in these ridiculous, like, these should be here, but they're not here. So, you know, I mean, especially this large ice cream cone idea and in a picnic basket, I just picture people taking their photographs in front of it and, you know, doing something stupid and putting it on Facebook, you know what I mean? Like, well, what is that then? That's another piece that comes from that, and sort of people enacting these things, like the virtual versus the real. So that's another duality here. So this isn't really here, but that object's here, but it's just an object, but so is a picnic basket, but so, you know, so that's sort of the new sort of bipolarity or duality that I'm looking at right now, rather than moving away from the diffraction film and all this rainbow business and all that, is really just into what we experience, what is there, and what could be there, or what should be there. That sort of idea. So, and it seemed really easy to do in a park setting where there, you go around to a lot of these sort of outer borough parks, there's nothing there. So it's just the idea of the park.
An open space with no equipment.
Yeah, and nobody really hanging out there. You know, nobody doing park, what we're supposed to do in the park, but who made that up? I think that's where it's going, and more into this sort of, you know, virtual versus synthetic and versus real. You know, it's what are our real experiences? And, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, living off of your computer and, you know, experiencing everything off of imagery that's digital is wrong, or, you know, I'm just saying, let's put it in the park. Let's see what it, let's bring it there, you know? So let's, you know, let's comment on it. Let's talk about it. So,
or in a different way, have you ever thought about dealing with that same idea with the, like, Manhattan parks, you know, Lower Manhattan, where it's like fenced off grass area. You can't go walk on it. It's just there, and you sit on a bench next to it.
Yeah, you're not allowed to go into it. So it's like, that's, I mean, it's almost exactly what I'm thinking about, because these things are there and they look like you could use them or be on them or be with them.
That looks like it'd be a nice place to be.
But you can't. It's the idea of it. You know, it's that we're alluding to the fact that you could be on that grass and it's pretty, but you're not allowed to step on that grass.
Yeah.
And sort of, you know, I mean, that's living in the city for my life is that's my outdoor experiences. You know, it's like that's what I grew up with and what I know. And I think that's interesting to comment on. And especially I think that we become even more and more in a digital age, which sounds silly, but it's like, you know, I have nieces and nephews that don't go into park. They wouldn't think about it. They'd be like, why would I do that? Why would I go? That's dirty. That's not, it's not, you know, and it's so.
They don't have video games at the park.
Right. There's not anything they want to do there. So why? I understand. So it's maybe, you know, that's the discussion as well is what, you know, what we're interested in doing anymore. Mm-hmm. And these simple ideas and these sort of, I don't know, utopian ideas of these beautiful landscapes with people just frolicking about, that's probably not happening somewhere, especially not here. So, I mean, I'm just interested in putting it out there, and I think it's light enough that I don't think the neighborhoods would be upset about it, but I think that they would be like, you know, this is odd. Why don't we, you know, make us think about stuff? And I think that's the most important thing for me in my work right now is, you know, I don't feel like I want to make objects anymore. I don't think that's interesting to me. I don't see the art world. What I'm interested in the art world doesn't seem to be going to painting shows or anything. You know, I feel limited. I get bored. And then I say, well, what am I doing? I'm still making these objects. It's a painting or a sculpture or object on the wall. And so it's maneuvering that and trying to, you know, not make my mark or make my voice heard, but, you know, work through these ideas and still learn, you know, without being in school or without, you know, being around professors or artists all the time and learn from our experiences and what we're doing right now and our society.
Yeah, and what you were saying about these pieces in the park being like billboard size, do you think it's possible you could translate your ideas into kind of like the sort of advertising mode where you, like, you know, they got the advertisements in the subway up along the top, you know, like execute them in kind of smaller but widespread avenues like that?
Yeah, I think that's great. I was also thinking about, I mean, what would be great is the scrims on buses that they do.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think advertising is moving in that direction too, so I think that's a fun place to be. And I mean, art and advertising has always been hand in hand, so I think that's definitely.
I guess even like getting to Keith Haring, he was using like blank subway ad spaces to create his work.
Absolutely. I mean, for me, how I envision the pieces in the park is that I even get them printed at Kinko's, so they even look like these really silly ones that are in front of banks and things like that. You know, like I mean, cost wise, billboards would be great, but I don't have that kind of funding. But you know, but yeah, but large and I usually work with things that you can get at a big box store or something like that, like an IKEA or things that are familiar to people, so that they're not that's not what they're thinking about when they're looking at it. That they're automatically comfortable with this object. So they see it every day. They know what it is, but then there's something a little off about it, so that they can go and look at it further and be like, okay, what is that? So, you know, these like that are riveted, you know, they have rivets in them. I string them up. It's real simple and they belong out there. That's where they live. And so that's also what I've been dealing with is working outdoors is how I can't use the materials I'm always used to. So I have to think about, well, what lives outdoors right now and then work with those materials, which is fun and liberating actually, because there are rules, you know, there's a set thing that's going to work or not get blown away or get ruined or, you know, that will weather outside for, you know, you have to think about it as a year installation, as a 2-year installation. And so these are all things that I never thought about before, but are super important if you want to move into that realm. We'll be right back.
So we've pretty much covered all of your kind of recent body of work. We haven't talked about this big guy that's sitting right here.
Yeah.
That's about a 5 by 8 foot panel with it's covered in rainbow stickers.
Yeah. That piece is called Rainbows Are Gay. That was the final piece I did for my MFA thesis show. And again, it was riffing on the sort of this pride and the frivolity of pride that I was feeling, and then moving into the first sort of interest in spectacle and this sort of this holographic thing that was happening. So, so basically, with this piece is it's hard to see in here, but if it's lit properly, I think it's like 50,000 stickers. They're about 1 inch to about a half inch in size.
Yeah.
And what happens is when it's lit and you're from a distance, it becomes one huge rainbow or two rainbow pieces. So it's all these pieces that make one thing, and it becomes very illusionist. It looks like an oil slick almost, like a huge oil slick that's lit up. And I think for me, it was something I knew I needed to do. I made the piece. People really liked it. I kind of live with this piece. I still don't know where it's going. I don't know what it's just there. I haven't put it away yet. It's also very large. I can't get it anywhere. But I think it was, again, like a really large sketch for what happened with Spectacle and with Hilo and all the other pieces to follow. It was... And I mean, I don't know why. I can't really answer why I make these really large, labor-intensive sketches, but they happen. And I think it's a way of making. And I can come to the studio and I can get to work on something, and then my mind can wander and I can think about other things that I want
to
do.
Yeah, you wouldn't need to focus on.
No, it's a task. Yeah,
peel on stick.
Correct. Absolutely. So it's a sort of, you know, it's meditative and. It's something to get you into the studio every day to keep working. I mean, much like these larger drawings that I'm doing and you know, just a repetitive action. And I haven't really figured out why that continues to happen, but it seems to be helpful for me to hash out other ideas that end up actually becoming, I guess, more valuable to me and actually get out in the world. Because a lot of these I don't end up showing. I mean, I showed this in a thesis show, but that piece hasn't shown, and a lot of these like smaller drawing pieces that I do, or this little, you know, tack piece or something, I don't show them. So it's they're in the studio, they get conversations going with people that I'm either, you know, a curator that I'm meeting with or somebody else, the gallery, and then it sort of gives them an insight to where my mind is and how my thought process is working for these other proposals that I'm making.
Yeah, I did notice that your table here is covered with, it's all covered with paper, and I put my stuff down on it, and then I quickly picked it up, and I was like, there's drawing on this.
Yeah.
And just like a couple hundred human figures in different colors of colored pencil is just another process piece.
This one I actually started, I think, a year ago, and I keep bringing it back out to work on it. I can't seem to get it done. I don't think the idea is totally there, but it's this series that I want to work on called Where Is My Dick, Where Is My Jane? And so there are these very, you know, they're like restroom outline characters of a male, and the next piece will be a female, and then what the third is sort of be like a triptych will be like this mass of everything. So sort of like, you know, what I believe everyone's moving into. We are not all male. We are not all female. We are not all, you know, it's this sort of, it just this sort of very simple take on sexuality, really, and sex and how it's dictated to us with simple, you know, graphic figures that we see everywhere and we don't think about, and we just go to that restroom, we just go to that, you know. So it's going somewhere. I have not figured out where, but that's a really slow piece. Like it's a lot of work, and it actually really is a painful piece to do, but I was looking at this the other day, and I was like, that's when I sort of decided, I was like, these are all just sketches, I don't know, but and then this is sort of where I work over here, and it's just a right now it's coming down from the high, this is sort of the high-low sketch that was here, and okay. it ended up looking nothing like this. So it's, you know, it's a pure black room, but I mean, it was a way to work through it. And, I mean, you can see here, this is the size of the gallery. It's basically like 85 square feet. So,
yeah.
I mean, this is only full, like 300 or 400, so the whole space, but, but yeah, so I think that, you know, I'm not someone that carries a sketchbook around. I'm not, you know, that's, I don't do a lot of writing. So I think for me, it's coming to the studio every day, doing these sort of maybe even, I don't want to say busy work, but they are busy work. They're tasks that I give myself. I have the rules. It's a set thing, and I don't have to think about it. So it feels good to me, and it makes me feel like I'm working. Even when I'm, you know, there's a lot of time that you have to think about stuff. You know, you can't just, you know, especially financially, I can't just make work all the time. And especially,
yeah, I think all artists need something that they can do without thinking about it, because you just get burnt out after processing so long.
Totally. and you know, it gives you time to second guess and third guess all your ideas, and then hopefully, you know, you get distracted and you start, you know, whatever, balling up paper in the corner or some, you know, some other thing that can become something else. Because it's like the rest of my time is spent doing like applications to different opportunities, and these public art applications are crazy. They want a lot of information, they want a lot of writing, they want a lot of, you know, sketches and proposals. And so I'd say that's 70% of my time right now is doing that until I get the next one. Hopefully the next one, and then hopefully, you know, you can have other people to help you out and do a lot of the, it's a lot of paperwork and it's a lot of like, you can't screw things up they disregard it. Like, you know, and you're up against people that are, you know, have had $500,000 opportunities already. So they're like, okay, I don't mind giving you $200,000. You know how to work with money. So it's, you know, my budgets have been $10,000 and like $3,000. That's not quite there, but it's, you know, that's the direction. I feel like there's money for artists there. This public art, this percent for art thing that's in almost every state, it seems. That money's constant. And it's
not
there.
Not in Kansas. Dude,
get out of there. Yeah.
Sam Brownback.
Yeah. That's terrible. But I mean, there's a lot of it out there, and it's open to, you know, international artists and you know, all over the United States. And it's the only place I see, at least for me, and I think for a lot of people, is where you can go right now and the things to look for and to shoot for. Because this idea of getting a gallery, or I don't, it just seems so foreign. I don't know anyone that's getting one, and I know a lot of very good artists. So it's, I think that idea is sort of archaic, and that someone's going to discover you, and you're going to have, even if you have a gallery, what do you have, a show every 1 or 2 years? And then if you sell it out, how do you live? You can't live off that. I don't care what you're selling your pieces for. You're not living off of that for 3 years.
Yeah.
With $200,000 in student loans or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I mean, you know, not to let the cat out of the bag. I'm sure a lot of people know about it, but it's like, this money's there. And, you know, and I think it helps you be a more flexible artist. And, you know, I have a lot of friends that are like, oh, I'm a painter. And I said, well, you're an artist. What does that mean? You just paint. And I couldn't see like limiting yourself to that. And I don't know how you can do that. I mean, I think that's great for some people, but I don't know how you exist if you really want to be an artist in this day and age, how you exist like that. How do you make any money? How do you, if you're not flexible in what,
it's more than one way to skin a cat.
If you really just want to be an artist, then I think you have to be flexible, and you have to be willing to take chances and leave your comfort zone, you know, like go out there and, you know, make public art. And even if no one's looking at it, even if it's in the middle of a field in Minnesota, wherever, you know, that no one in New York's probably going to go see, get the images from it. It's out there. It lives there. Someone's going to see it. So I think that's for me where I need to go. And, because I think the idea of, you know, the 80s, getting this gallery and just becoming famous is not happening. So, I mean, for most. I think it's more exciting.
I don't really know if there is anything such as like a famous artist anymore. Like,
yeah,
Basquiat, Keith Haring. I don't know that anybody's, just with the media fragmentation, is going to get that much attention anymore.
Right. And I feel like
source.
Yeah, and I feel like artists right now, you have to be a business. This is a real job. Like you mm-hmm. You have to do paperwork. You have to do taxes. You have to do, even if you're making zero. Like I'm not making any money, and I'm still, you know, I have to whatever. I incorporated. I do this back stuff because when it does happen, you want to be ready. And, and even if the little bit of money that comes in, you have to be able to deal with it and have budgets and have. I mean, it is the real world, and I think this. A lot of people have this idea of artists sitting in a studio and just creating all day and just being able to, and that is romantic at best. Like, I wish it was that.
But like, time's over, kids. Time to get to work.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's time. You know, we're talking about the percentage of time you do, you know, your business side of things, and then the rest of it, you're hopefully able to make stuff. But, you know, I think that's the real side of being an artist, and it's like any other designer or any other business person. I mean, except you have to also do the creative side of things, you know, rather than just go to the office every day. So,
yeah.
So it's a constant.
But. If you get good enough, I guess you get assistance to deal with the grunt work.
Yeah, after a while. Yeah, after a while. Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, I think it's a matter of control as well. You have to be able to trust people. And it's like, I mean, I work for an artist too, and I do a lot of her preparator type stuff. And so, I mean, there's also your day job. And so trying to navigate that and not get burnt out working for another artist is difficult sometimes because you can see other artists that, you know, that you've worked for over the years and you're basically helping them to better themselves. And then you can't help but think about the time you spend there because you need to make money. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, I could be doing this. I could be doing this. I could be doing this. And so, I mean, I found a good situation with the person I work for because our work is very different. I like what I do for her. I do a lot of painting and prepping of panels. I don't do any of that in my studio, so it feels good. You know, it's a totally different environment for me. And I mean, some friends work as preparators and for whatever, for Sotheby's or something like that. And they do, you know, it's like manual labor. And so that feels good to them. And I think it's finding those type of jobs that don't burn you out so that you can spend the rest of the evening into the morning, whenever, doing your own work. So it's a lot.
Well, very good. Anything you need to follow up with or touch back on?
I don't think so.
Well, it's good talking to you. Thanks for meeting with me here. We'll see you around in the future.
Thank you.
Thanks. And that concludes this episode of Studio Sessions with our guest Ryan Turley. You can find his work online at ryanwturley.com. You can also learn more about me at my website, mattcoleman.com. If you'd like to support this program, you can send a donation through PayPal to studiosessionspodcast@gmail.com. Even if you only send $1, your donation helps guarantee I can continue providing interviews with interesting artists for your listening pleasure. And of course, don't forget to visit bigredandshiny.com for future episodes, along with other high-quality arts and culture content. Thank you for listening, and see you next time on Studio Sessions.